access is the problem, and no one has solved or tried to solve the problem of access. They've just said, hey, here's some resources, and here's what we're doing. We're going to go and do these events, and we're going to have these talks, but we're still not actually accessing the individuals who need it, because sometimes the people who need it don't even know they need it at that time. They don't know that it exists, so you can't have impact on people who don't know you exist.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we have Tim Bard-Levins joining the show to discuss how we can improve diversity in design leadership. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Fostermade, a versatile web development agency specializing in custom application development, content management systems, and user experience design. Through partnerships with designers, agencies, and organizations, Fostermade is committed to building better digital experiences. Visit fostermade.co to learn more. This episode is also sponsored by Statamic. The Statamic team is excited to announce the brand new Statamic Marketplace, the official spot to find, share, and sell add-ons and themes. With 40 different native field types, including Bard, a brand new field type designed for modular, long-form content, there's never been a better time to start building with this delightfully flexible, flat file-first CMS. Learn more at statamic.com and save 20% on your first license during the month of May with the code CLICKCLICKCLICK.
We've discussed diversity on our show before. We talked with Farooq Atesh and Ash Dryden about the challenges in the tech industry overall. And then we chatted with Jess D'Amico about the challenges of producing a conference that celebrates diversity and inclusion. And today we're turning our focus specifically to the design industry and leadership in particular. Joining us in today's talk is Timothy Bard-Levins, who has accomplished a lot since he started designing professionally 5 years ago. His design journey has taken him from coast to coast, and now he's at Microsoft helping lead product innovation and UX, while also heading up their culture efforts to foster greater inclusion throughout the company. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so I am from South Carolina, where, you know, studied undergrad in design and just found my way going through the country to Texas, working for Capital One in addition to smaller startups, and somehow found my way appearing in Seattle, working at Microsoft. And so I've been here for a little over a year now, and it's been a really interesting journey just getting ingrained into deeper into design, of course, but more also deeper into the tech industry and how different design is in the tech industry versus, you know, like brand marketing or something of that nature. And so, yeah, it's been an interesting journey going through and, you know, developing product design, but also looking at organizational culture, especially in a company this big with so much history. It's just been really fun. And, you know, outside of work, I actually I have a role as director of creative strategy for an organization called Provoke, and really their main focus is around servicing change organizations. So they're a creative agency that mainly works around nonprofits who have a focus on equity, on environmental practices, health and human services, just things that make the world a better place. So I have a lot going on. It's pretty fun.
You know, before we get into today's episode, I'm curious, how did you get into design in the first place back in South Carolina?
Oh, I never wanted to be a designer. I actually wanted to, I actually wanted to be a writer. And I'm actually a really, really great writer. And usually when I go back and visit university, my old professors always ask if I'm still writing. But yeah, I was an English major, and I had this dream of being the chief editor of Jet magazine, because it was the blackest magazine I could think of outside of Essence. And so I was like, okay, I need to learn layouts. I need to learn how to lay out design and photography and whatnot. And so it was my second semester sophomore year that I jumped into design a bit. And I also started working for the Office of Student Activities, and man, they're now my godmothers, but my two supervisors, these just wonderful women, they taught me so much about myself and told me, like, they helped me realize that I was, I guess, my self-worth. And so they gave me an opportunity to start designing posters for events for the office. And then by the time I graduated from university, I went to Coastal Carolina University, which is in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. By the time I graduated from Coastal Carolina, I was designing basically material for the entire university.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so I actually officially changed my major to design second semester of my junior year, which is crazy, of course, because I'm like 2 seconds from graduation. But it was great. You know, it was probably one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. It was the first time I was ever engaged in something I really cared about it. And I would stay up to 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning just making stuff and, you know, get back up at 7 o'clock to go to the office. And like, I was the only student worker who worked 40 hours a week. And, it was amazing. I did that. Plus I went to class, of course. Plus I also had a second job. So it was really good for me.
Wow. So do you still get to do writing? Do you do writing for pleasure?
No, because I'm really lazy. I mean, I love to write. And
yeah.
I do a lot of writing internally. So like, for example, with my work with Provoke, a lot of the writing I do is around how do we start to tell really beautiful stories. So I think that's something that's always been my superpower. And I brought that over to design with me is I am, I think, a masterful storyteller. And I know how to tell a great story. This is what has helped me be successful in product design, is being able to just create these very high level layouts, but the story behind it and selling that has been the thing that really propels me forward.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think that storytelling also leads really well to our topic today, which is diversity in leadership, because there's a journey to get there. But before we dive deep into that topic, let's start with the basics. Mm-hmm. What does diversity mean when it comes to the design industry? A basic definition.
So typically, I would say that it's about a difference in backgrounds and upbringings and experience. But specifically for design, it's hard for me to go that deep because at its surface, it's not diverse racially,
mm-hmm.
and is not very diverse as it pertains to gender either, especially once you start moving up in leadership. And so honestly, I think I am a firm believer of inclusive design. And so I really mm-hmm. do believe and am a believer in having a diverse background and diverse sets of experiences and how you bring that to the table. But racial diversity in design is so lacking. I feel like that's like the baseline almost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it almost makes it, you can only tell certain kinds of stories if you only have a certain set of storytellers at the table designing and writing and communicating.
Right. And that's the thing, right? It's to understand that we are designers, to understand we're among the most powerful professions in the world because we speak to the world in a way that many can't. And with that being said, when you have a limited number of people being able to tell that story, that means that we're not reaching the world the way we need to be truly serviceable mm-hmm. designers.
And has that evolved since you started in design?
Oh, God. It's about the same. You know, mm-hmm. like, I could say that, so Coastal Carolina was a PWI, a predominantly white institution. So I was the only black person in my class. Most roles I've had in my career, I've always been the only black person in design. It wasn't until actually into the new team I just recently joined a few weeks ago, where there's two other people who are black. One is from Nigeria and the other is from the Caribbean. And I can't remember the exact place, but she's from the Caribbean. And so like, they're the only people who I've worked with that look like me in a very long time. And if I look across the company wide, how many black designers there are, there's still not many.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a thing of like, I don't think it's changed. I think we all understand the statistics behind it, but I don't know if we've actually worked to diversify the industry.
Mm-hmm. What do you think that, well, just to speak on your own personal experience, has that affected how you design, what your learning process was, or even, I don't know, what it felt like to be on a team where you didn't see anyone like yourself?
Well, when you start in your undergraduate career and see no one like you, especially within your major area, then it's not really a surprising thing. So I can't say it's affected me in a way that it's obvious to me. It's more so it's just something I know and understand and have gotten used to. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where, for me personally, it means that I have to always be the best, or if not, I won't say the best. I always have to be just very good. Like, I have to almost represent those who should be hired after me and with me, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. And I think many people, especially culturally, you start to, especially if you have a background that's not of the majority, you start to feel some of that pressure of, like, I have to represent more than just myself sometimes. And at the same token, I have to still be authentically myself. And so I have this juxtaposition in my brain, in a sense of, like, how can I be authentically Timothy Barge Levins, but at the same token, I represent a group of underserved individuals who would love to be in the same role that I'm in, or even farther than me, mm-hmm. and make sure that I'm representative enough that someone gives that person a chance based off of their interactions with me.
And then there's no room right. for error.
But I'm amazing, so I never have error.
And that responsibility that you're talking about, is that something that you have embraced, or has it been difficult to feel that responsibility? Just, is it just assumed?
I just like to say that I'm amazing and I do amazing things. You know, honestly, I come in with my authentic self. And mm-hmm. so I try not to, if I think about it, it's something that I intrinsically think about. It's not something that is on my mind all the time. For me, is I have a high set of goals. There's a certain thing that I want to do with my life, and there are certain things I want to do with my career. And I push for those consistently. And I ensure that in doing so, like, I am creating a positive culture around me. I'm creating a circle of greatness, in a sense, around me, of, like, people who really enjoy engaging with me, mm-hmm. who enjoy working with me, who feel like they get the best of themselves when working with mm-hmm. me. And so that's kind of what I care about. And I think in doing so, that's how I help create those pathways.
That sounds a lot like lead by example, which is all about design leadership. But what do you believe design leadership is? What does it mean to you?
It's design leader is interesting because their role is almost twofold. It's to think of the folks in which that person's team, from a job standpoint, that person's team is impacting. Like, think of the user, in a sense, but it's also to lead and inspire and to help grow and nurture ideas internally. But it's, for me specifically, it's this part of, it's a certain rationale to it. It's this thing of, yeah, you can be amazingly creative, but how do we make it real? Like, what are your thoughts behind it? How do you put real, why did you make this decision? Is it just because you thought it was pretty, or is there a firm thought process behind it? And help mm-hmm. me understand those thought processes. And so I think a really strong design leader is one who really works to get their team, the people that they lead, to be thinkers, to be thoughtful, and really to be consistent, to really have consistency in what they do and why they do it. And most of all, to be empathetic, to have empathy for their user, empathy for their audience, empathy for the folks that work around them, empathy for other disciplines. Too many times we as designers work across multiple different disciplines with many different people, and to have empathy with those that we work with is super important. God knows I've seen so many snobbish designers in my life, and God knows how many times I've deleted someone from Facebook or Instagram because they posted a picture of a menu and talked about how bad the design was. I'm like, how elementary can you be? A design leader doesn't stare at something and say, oh, how horrible is this? They say, how can we make this better? And they work towards doing that. We should be action takers, not critiquers all the time.
In your experience working, you know, as you were developing as a designer and coming up in your career, working with people who were in those leadership roles, did they model this for you, or was that the norm, or was that the exception?
Okay, this is going to sound really weird, but it's going to go deep for a second, right? So I haven't had the best relationship in my life with my father. And so what I learned from my father is not what he did, but what he didn't do, and how I filled in those gaps and said, this is the type of person I'm going to be in regards to that. And so many of my leaders, I've taken that same approach of, if you're not showing me what I need from you, you're not showing me what I feel like I expect from you as a leader, then I model my behavior and my thought processes on the opposite of what you've done or what you're doing. Mm. I'm the youngest of three. And so being the youngest, I'm really good at looking at what my brothers and sisters did and say, okay, I'm not going to make those mistakes. So that's kind of, I guess that's how I've learned so far, is, you know, I've actually I've rarely had a leader who truly embodied the things that I believe in, mm. and the things that I find that are important. And so a lot of what I know and a lot of what I do is based off of just an amalgamation of inputs that I've pulled over the years of what I think works really well and what I believe is the right direction.
So what do you believe is the right direction? What are these responsibilities?
Oh, it's always hard, right? I mean, it depends on what level you're talking about. If you mean from a just simple leading a team perspective, mm-hmm. that's one thing. Where if you're talking about industry leadership, that's totally different. Mm. Because for me, you know, leading a team, again, it bases on empathy. It bases on, for me, especially in tech as the user, is based on what are user-centric problems and how do we solve those problems in beautiful ways. It's based on really caring about function over form and saying, hey, does this work really well in service and need? Now let's make it beautiful versus let's make it beautiful, but it doesn't mm-hmm. serve any need and doesn't serve anyone but ourselves. So to break out of that mentality of self-serving design. But if you think about it from a meta level and of industry leadership, it's how can I continue to be the voice of the problem and say, hey, this is what needs to change. But also mm-hmm. being an action taker and say, okay, so I know that this is a problem. How can I personally step up and help make that change? How can I do more than just go to conferences and say, oh, well, only 6% of the design industry is Black? Well, I mean, I can tell that, say that a million times, but I'm not providing tools or resources to those who want to step up and be in design. Mm-hmm. I'm not providing mm-hmm. tools and resources to companies to help them increase their design talent pool. There's so many things that can be done outside of just speaking. And so I think that's the responsibility of an industry leader is to figure that part out.
And why is it important for that these industry leaders at this industry level for them to be better representative, for them to be not only talking about the statistics, but representing the opportunity for change?
So if I'm mistaken, there's a statistic or a factoid that says that by 2055, Caucasian or white people will be the minority in America. And so we realize that that's not very far away. That's within mm-hmm. most of our lifetimes. And knowing that if we are still communicating and representing a subset, or we're making design decisions, or we're creating an industry in which only focuses on specific areas and specific schools that also happen to be predominantly white institutions, then how are we setting ourselves up for the future? Like, how are we learning how to communicate now across cultures? And so in a way that we can use that and leverage it in the future for our children and our children's children. And so, like, for me, that's like really important. It's not really about just right now. It's about this is the future. This is the way the world is going. Pretty soon, races will more and more become very diluted to a point where mm-hmm. there's no Black, white, there's no Asian versus African. There's just like there's cultural differences as far as location, but as far as actual mm-hmm. skin color, that will start to even out. And when that happens, how do we start to communicate with people at their core, which is their culture, which is their location, where they're from, where they believe, as opposed to from a very centric perspective of, oh, well, I'm only going to bring people in, or I'm only going to hire people from RISD because, mm-hmm. you know, they produce the best designers. And as opposed to there's a state school in Mississippi who is a HBCU, but it has some really great design talent, and we should really see what they're doing and how they're working on things. And same for HSIs or for Hispanic-based institutions or for Native American colleges and universities. There's a wonderful designer named Sadie Redwing, and she has been going across the country just speaking about indigenous people and their design in America, because that's largely a section of our population that we don't know about who has really beautiful design language. And so, you know, how do we leverage those people and connect with them now? Because soon, right now, it's like a nice to have in a sense, but soon it's going to be a requirement.
So let's talk about the how. What would be a first step?
So I'll say first and foremost, I used to be a member of AIGA. For those who don't know, it is the American Institute of Graphic Artists. And I recently, in a very public way, in a sense, left the organization. And I think it made maybe a slightly bigger splash than I expected, only because I'd been on the board of directors. I knew many of the people. I know the executive director and like a lot of people. And so there were interesting reactions back and forth. But one of the bases in which I left the organization was directly related to their diversity task force. which for it had been around for many years, and it largely, in my opinion, had done little to nothing. I know they had the Women's Leadership Initiative, and I actually spoke to the woman, Layla is her first name. She worked with AIGA to create the Women's Leadership Kit, and you know, she and I talked about this, some of the challenges with that and how, like, she wanted it to be more, but because of just the organization, how things were done, it just didn't get the traction it needed to truly be a resource for women in design and how to help them become stronger, better, more empowered leaders. Mm-hmm. The thing is that we have these great organizations who bring in millions of dollars from both membership as well as from donations and from other types of grants. And yet they don't turn around and say, okay, so instead of us only having chapters in these areas, how about we work to create a chapter in Mississippi? Because there, one doesn't exist mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. But Mississippi mm-hmm. has many historically black universities. It has many universities in general. It has some of the really great just universities, period. But there's no design culture there as far as AIGA is concerned. There's no chapter for them there. In South Carolina, we had one chapter. And it spanned across two cities, Columbia, South Carolina, and Charleston, South Carolina. And so they would meet in either of those cities. Within South Carolina, as far as I'm aware, I only know of two design agencies. One is the Brandon Agency, which is in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And the other in Columbia, which is, the name escapes me now. I was just talking about it recently. But yeah, like those are the only two I know, but there's really no true design culture. And so when I've heard stories of folks when I left the organization, they said, yeah, we've tried so hard to do more diversity events and to bring in more diverse speakers, but we get pushback from people. Oh, this person's mm-hmm. never been heard of before. Who would come to mm-hmm. see this person? It's like, okay, so how do we actually let minorities know there are people that look like them in this industry, or this industry even exists, if we don't even feel like we can bring in speakers to talk about it because they're not well known across the world? We'll spend great amounts of money to bring in Aaron Draplins and all these other mm-hmm. folks.
Yeah.
But like, what about these other lesser known people in the country who are doing really great things, and maybe not on a massive level, but on, you know, at least on some level, they have some level of experience and of strong background. And largely I've seen when it came to at least AIGA, let's say ethnically diverse speakers that they do have, there are only a few of them, and they put many of them on a pedestal. And so some of them are close friends of mine and they do amazing work, but it's the same people all the time. And it's like, what about the lesser known folks? You know, what about these people who no one knows about? And so I think that's kind of one issue I have, is really these organizations who have the resources but aren't doing the right kind of outreach. And they think they're doing the right thing by having a couple of events here and there and saying, hey, we have a task force and we're going to put these speakers up, or these specific speakers up, all the time. But it really doesn't lead to anything. Mm-hmm. And so like, there's something around getting into the community early. Most people, like, I didn't know about what design was until really I was in college. I mm-hmm. never knew there was a thing as graphic design. I never knew there was a person who created logos. But if you hear some of the greatest designers today talk, they speak about how when they were young, they were looking at logos and stuff, and they were inspired when they were 4, 5, and 6 mm-hmm. years old. But we don't have that resource. The closest thing I ever heard about design was game design, is because I remember a Full Sail commercial from when I was young. And so, like, so what else is out there? How do we teach youth that design is a very viable industry in which they can make mm-hmm. a lot of money and really do well for themselves? How do we touch on them in high school to get them into it? And how do we make sure they're supported in college? And then when they graduate college, the level of entry into design is so high because a Mac is $2,000 and Adobe is a certain amount of money every month. And then you have to pay for web hosting for your website because it's the only way people can see your work. And then you may have to get it printed into a print portfolio to walk into an office. And you need all these things. Like, so if it costs you $5,000 or $10,000 to join in an industry, how do you expect someone who is in poverty, whose parents maybe make $5,000 in 7 months, mm-hmm. how can they actually help to afford to get into an industry so expensive? How do we change the definition of design where it's not just traditional print and brand marketing, but user experience is really a part of it? It is a piece of design. It is the heart of design. What about those designers who create pamphlets for church or party posters, or they create CD covers for local artists? Like, we keep so many people out of the industry based off of what we feel is true design versus not, that it's just, it's so hard to make impact.
Wow.
It is. So I get that feeling too. I've worked for a Fortune 500 company. I know all about like the lip service that they can spin about where they're putting money to do good based on whatever the PR mission is at the time. And it does start to feel like some of these like diversity programs or task force or whatever commitment to hiring XYZ by a certain year, they feel like PR versus actual making a difference that is meaningful and lasting and can spread.
Right.
And so is that strictly, is it a money thing or is it really just this sort of, we have the task force, let's pat ourselves on the back. That's all we need to think about.
Right. That's a really great question, right? I think money and really even speaking, it all equates to one thing, which is access. How do we provide mm-hmm. access to the accessless? And so, for example, you have someone, person of color or a woman or whoever, some type of intersectionality in which they go to a conference and speak. And the people who are at the conference are so inspired. But the people who are at the conference could afford to get to the conference. They could afford the entry mm-hmm. to get into the conference. They can afford the flight and the hotel. So what about that person who can't afford those things, who's inspired, and so they have to hopefully try to find someone on TED Talks. Oh, but wait, you have to be a member just to access these videos after the event. Or you have to, if they didn't do it on like a TED Talk or something, there's no access to it because you missed it because it was content mm-hmm. specifically for that event. And so we've now put ourselves into a bubble in which we can't even diversify from a messaging perspective. It's all hidden behind a wall, and you have to get up over that wall just to get to that information, to get inspired by those people who you've never heard of before. It's one of those things where access is the problem, and no one has mm-hmm. solved or tried to solve the problem of access. They've just said, hey, here's some resources and here's what we're doing. We're going to go and do these events and we're going to have these talks, but we're still not actually accessing the individuals who need it, because sometimes the people who need it don't even know they need it at that time.
Right.
They don't know that it exists. So mm-hmm. you can't have impact on people who don't know you exist.
Right. That reminds me of an article. It's not necessarily related to the web or design industry, but it was when Trevor Noah took the helm of The Daily Show and he was trying to hire his new writing staff and all that fun stuff. And he noticed that the majority of applicants were all white.
Mm-hmm.
And then so obviously, he's half black. He has a community of friends of diverse backgrounds. He personally asked them, like, hey, open positions, why didn't you apply?
Mm-hmm.
And then person stared at him and said, I didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
My agent doesn't know about it. Or they don't have an agent because they are a person of color. And it's just much more difficult to get certain representation even for an agency to get these like scripts and to get these particular opportunities even on their table. So both Trevor Noah and Samantha Bee had to do outreach outside of their regular circles in order to diversify their staff because it was important to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was like an interesting point that's also true here in our web industry, in our design industry, is that outreach is necessary
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that it's necessary and it's also work. Because I think that all the things that you're mentioning to me resonates, and it's also very relevant, like, you know, in tech conferences as well. And a common complaint is that we did do the outreach and then no one got back to us, or, oh, it's so hard, or I don't know certain people. And it's just, again, putting the burden on the disenfranchised to fix the problem as opposed to a person of privilege and resources to just do the extra dang work. Mm-hmm. Just do the work, people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's
well, and the mentality around that, right, is sometimes, well, I had to work hard. You're going to have to work hard, too. I mean, let's be honest. If you think about politics or anything else, that's kind of what it boils down to when people think about entitlement is, oh, well, we had to work hard for our money and you should, too. We shouldn't be giving you these handouts. You should have to go and work for it just like everyone else. And so,
well, to hit on that point, because that really connects with me, because the opportunities that I've gotten in my career as a female leader in the web have come to me because someone did outreach
yes,
to me.
Ditto.
And as a result, that is my mentality. I don't have some mentality of, oh, I had to work hard, so now you do too. I'm like, oh, that's how I got this, so I'm going to try and do that for other people. So if you bring in more people and you create opportunities, you may be fostering that mindset, and then that kind of, you know, that whole cliche pay it forward kind of thing, the opposite of what you're describing.
Mm-hmm. You see, the other interesting thing is if you think about industry from like, okay, who gets the opportunity and how, I'll say that it's slightly related, but not, but it is. So in the Seattle Times, there was the article about a woman who said working at Microsoft was probably one of the most lonely years of her life. And it's just really a person's perspective on working for Microsoft. And of course, our company is really big on like making sure we're diversifying. There's like this new culture they're really trying to push forward and whatnot. And I'm not sure if I'll get in trouble for it, but they sent out, our leadership sent out an email to us basically saying like, hey, this email, we're aware of this article and we kind of just want to talk about it. But the tone shifted almost immediately. It was like, a lot of this information was dated, and here are all the numbers that prove that we're doing really well with women. And so I actually emailed the leadership. So this was all of our senior leaders, including Satya. And I said, this email is the proof that there is a separation between what leadership believes and per people's actual experiences. Mm-hmm. But I also said that if you look at people's experiences, you'll understand that if you look at the majority, and in this case, this is white men and Asian men inside of Microsoft, they are hired and promoted based off of their potential. They did pretty good work. And so because they're showing potential, they're hired and promoted. Whereas if you're a woman or a minority of any sort, then you are hired and promoted based off of experience. What have you done? What can you prove? Mm-hmm. Have you proven yourself? So like even myself personally, I have run into this where for a year I led major projects. Like I owned the core UX for Microsoft Edge, which is the entire look and feel. It's how people navigate through the app. And so in a sense, I owned the thing that people had to interact with every day. So I had support from people who were 2, 3, 4 levels above me. I had all this really great support, but I was told, give it 6 more months. We have to prove that you'll continue this same trajectory before you get a promotion. And so for me, it's this question of, am I getting that because I'm a black man or because I actually have to just prove myself? But I can't actually talk to anyone or complain to anyone about it because I'm unsure of which it is. Like, I'm not sure, is it because I'm black or is it just because they just need me to prove myself a bit more? But then I look around and say, oh, well, this person was promoted because they did pretty well in this thing. It was about 6 months they worked on it. And they were given this, I guess, because they had the potential to do more. And so this is an interesting thing that you have to deal with as a person of color, at least from my perspective of I am consistently having to prove myself worthy as opposed to being hired based off of my potential or promoted based off of my potential. It also depends on the person. But that's like the same thing as you think about with the design industry. It's people who are trying to prove that they're just good enough. Like, yes, I do have creative chops. I do have visual chops. I can do X, Y, and Z. As opposed to, I've done these things, and I would love to learn and do more. Can you hire me based off of some of my experience and off of my drive and ability to want to do more? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't really happen.
I would say this reminds me of another article I read specific about women in business. In that statistically, women will only apply for a job if they have 100% of all the requirements checked off in the box. And they're less likely to apply if they're even lacking in one or two. In comparison, men, specifically white men, will be like, 70%. I will apply. Mm-hmm. And that just really resonates with me. Like the experience that you're explaining is quite similar in that, you know, a lot of minorities and women, it's a constant prove. And then go beyond that as well.
Mm-hmm. And on top of it, that extra effort of proving isn't even valued.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Yes. Like it's just, well, that's what you've got to do. That's not considered, well, they did the extra hard work by proving, you know what I mean? Like it's not valued the same way.
You know, what I've found, and actually I'm not sure if it's just because it's me or what, but I've forced myself to flip my mentality on a lot of that stuff. In a sense, I've forced myself to operate as if I'm a white man. And not from the fact of like losing who I am, because when I'm at work, like when I first was hired in Microsoft, my intro email to the organization, the very first sentence was, I'm the black guy. When I went to my interview, it was, I'm the black guy. In fact, it was funny because actually I made someone uncomfortable because I was walking by them and I said, I was only hired because of affirmative action. I was just a diversity hire. And it was a joke, it was a self-deprecating joke, but it made them uncomfortable to a point where they went back and told the person how it made them uncomfortable as opposed to approaching me. But just show, like, that's just me, though. Like, I am unapologetically Black, and it's completely fine. And either you're comfortable with it or you're not. And many people aren't, and it's fine. But the folks who are come to really enjoy that, and they feel like they have a sense of openness and ability to communicate with me on a very human level, as opposed to trying to understand who I am and where I stand. It's like, I'm very open about that. But in the sense of I operate as a white man is... where some people, they work crazy hours and whatnot to try to get things done to prove that they have the time to, they can do it and get it done. I have a very strict schedule. For the most part, I don't stay at work after 4 p.m. Typically on Fridays, not after 3. And I don't check emails at night or on the weekend, or at least I don't respond to them. I'm very firm about that because I set boundaries because, you know, it's just what I have to do for my life. When I apply for roles, I always apply for a role based off if I see I can do the thing, then I'll apply for it. There have been so many roles I've applied to, and I've actually interviewed for director-level positions, head of design positions, and I've applied and gotten fairly far in a lot of those application processes, and some of them went nowhere because of the fact that I knew I could do the job. I just wanted someone to give me the opportunity to do it. And so every time I'm looking for something new, I'm always looking 1, 2, 3, and 4 levels above me because I know that there's someone who's going to say yes, and when they do, I'm going to rock it out, and they're going to love the fact that I did it. Design is the easy part. Once you learn design, it's really about kind of honing in your skills and playing with different techniques. But for the most part, it's the easy thing. The hard part is the strategy. The hard part is the politics that come with working in corporate life and with the selling yourself and selling the work and the telling stories and stuff. That's the really nitty-gritty part of design. And so when I understood that personally, I was like, okay, this is how I'm going to operate from now on. And that's how I continue to operate. And so far, it's kept me successful and it's kept my shoe collection very large.
That actually reminds me of our episode with Vanessa Dewey about design thinking to smash workplace inequality. And she said a similar thing as in like think and behave like a white guy. And that helps bring certain opportunities that you may be hesitant personally to try to pursue normally.
Right.
But I want to take a step back and talk a bit more about something that you kind of touched on about, you know, you're really open about what you're thinking and open to other people about yourself. And that leads me to something that I read that you wrote about radical transparency as a way to improve diversity in design and work, et cetera, and so forth. Can you talk a little bit more about that and why it's important?
There is a very human thing about being transparent, about saying we're not good enough yet, but we're trying. And here are the things we're doing to actually get there. Because with transparency also hopefully leads with or follows strategy. And so it's saying that here's everything we're trying to do in every single way. Here are the touch points we're making. Here's some of the stuff that we're actually even thinking about. Like, this isn't solid yet, but we're thinking about it. Because what happens is that it inspires other people to help put in to that. It's really a vehicle in which we say that this is everything that's on our minds. Come to us with your thoughts as well. How can we make this better? How can we do this together? So it's a play of inclusiveness that it really plays to. It's like things shouldn't be done in a silo, especially. So I think with that one, I wrote it specifically around with AIGA and the fact that I had no idea what they were doing internally unless I was either on the task force or I was friends with the executive board. And so I thought in my mind, I'm like, how can I help with this? How can I help push this forward? How can I be a part of this and help it grow if I don't even know what's going on? How can I be effective in my own personal life or as a part of this organization if I don't know anything? And so that's where the transparency comes in, is we as people don't need the perfect picture. For some reason, executives have it in their mind that they have to have a perfectly laid out plan for people to understand. You have to have the field laid out with the greens and everything so people can just see the beautiful prairie with all the flowers already there, as opposed to the ugly field that's torn up with trash in it and saying, hey, this is the plan for the field. Let's all work on getting it together. And so that's what I mean by the radical transparency, is how can we really democratize the strategy around increasing diversity in design? Like, how can we democratize that strategy in a way that people feel like they're invested in and there's actually work being done? Because there's one thing to say, hey, we're doing this stuff, but it's not really actually anything going on. It's another thing to say, here's this stuff, here's everything we've done so far, here's the next initiatives if you want to take a part of it. And then we see, oh, there's action being done. This isn't just mm-hmm. pretty words. These are kinetic words. They're moving, they're doing things, they have action to them. And so that's really what I mean when I say radical transparency, is just the thought of letting people have insight into it and then having the door open for them to join in.
Right. I think this also reminds me that leadership should be the ones that are radically transparent and communicating this on a regular basis.
Yes.
I think one criticism that some people say is like, well, why didn't you ask me what was right. going on? So again, putting the impetus on marginalized people to always do the outreach, to always do particular work, as opposed to leadership actually explaining, which is what leaders are supposed to be doing.
The interesting thing is with that is people try to hinge on this thing of grassroots efforts.
Right.
Grassroots efforts are unsuccessful without a leader. There is no way for the community to get behind a cause and to get other people to get behind a cause without a leader to help push it forward, to give the idea, to make all the high level, like push from a higher level. So if I think about my work here at Microsoft on culture, it was within my specific studio, is about 200 people. The biggest problem we had was originally it was a bunch of ICs or individual contributors who were trying to make this cultural change. And it wasn't working and it wasn't pervasive because we did not have leadership on board. Typically, when you need change, is basically you make a change sandwich, right? You have leadership pushing down from the top and you have the individual contributors or the people themselves pushing up from the bottom. And then those folks in the middle are basically pushed and collapsed in between. And so you have this thing of, okay, leadership believes in it. The people believe in it. We all believe in it. It's a thing. And so that was one of the biggest problems, was how do we get leadership to get buy-in on this? How do we tell them that positive culture equates to business innovation and product innovation? Mm-hmm. Like, how do we sell that story in a way that they get on board and they realize that having a set of values for an organization is important? How do we help them understand all these different things that they need to know to work with us and to be proponents of the message we're trying to push forward and make pervasive throughout the whole organization? And the same goes for everything else. Like, same goes for industry changes and everything in between, is how do we create this grassroots effort that's led by someone? And it can't be mm-hmm. led by someone who's constantly at the bottom with the rest of the group. It has to be someone of power, because without that person of power, then things won't change.
So do you have any thoughts about how to get those people in power, those leaders, to be actual people of color, to be the people who not only can drive the small change, but be representative of the change actually having happened by reaching a position of leadership?
So that's the hard part, right? It's hard mainly because if I think of this from a industry-wide, there's a group of people and they have a group of friends in which they typically recommend or promote or whatever to be in that role with them or to take over after them. And so it's really hard to say, hey, this is how you get to the top. Because honestly, it's something that I'm scratching and scraping for myself. Like every conversation I have, every job I apply for, every job that's recommended to me, every recruiter that reaches out, like I'm looking for the next step to move up. And I'm pushing on it myself because I just have the mindset that I'll do it myself before I wait on someone to do it for me. But it's really hard. Like I'll use Microsoft as an example again. We always have organizational changes. I know right about now, everyone in America knows that Terry Myerson left the company. And so like there's these shifts and things that are happening. So for those who don't know Terry Myerson, he was basically the Windows guy. He owned all of Windows. He was one of the makers of the Windows phone. But or they say it happened under his leadership. But when he left, we didn't bring in a new person to take over him and that potentially had a diverse background. We just shifted leaders around. In my old organization, when one of our leaders left the company, we didn't bring in a new leader from outside. We didn't bring in a leader of color or anything like that. We shifted a guy from one organization to another. And even though he says he cares about culture and he's passionate about it and he has his mindset on it, and these are things he's been thinking about for the past 8 or 10 years, he's still a white male. And he can try his best to promote up other people who look different. But there's consistently this thing of, there are people I know and there are people I don't know. And the people I don't know, I'm not willing to take chances on, especially in executive level positions. I prefer to take chances on the people I do know because at least I have a rapport with them, I've worked with them, and I feel like I know their ability. That's the really hard part is how do you get executives to change their mind? How do you get executives to hire people and promote people who are completely different, who don't fit into the norm of that role, who may have a very diverse or different background?
It's almost like your point about access. Right. Like, how do leaders get access to people who don't even know that design could be something they do?
Right. And the flip side is, how do you get leaders to understand that design isn't about just making pretty pictures? One thing, I use Microsoft as an example a lot, mainly because I feel as though it can be attributed to many other industries, but also because it's my reality right now. And one of the things I asked some folks who have been here far longer than I asked them, are there any senior leaders who have a design background who are not only in the design organization? Because we have design leaders who lead the design organizations, but we don't have, for example, a person with a background in design who is the senior vice president of Windows. It's a person who has a project management or a program management background. It's a person who has maybe a developer background. But there is no one in design in those roles. And yet our job is to synthesize business, user expectations, and tech feasibility to create products. And so if our job is to synthesize those things, wouldn't we be great leaders over a product as opposed to just design? But that's just not the reality we live in. How do we change that mindset? I don't know. Sometimes some people in design feel like it's good enough that there is a design organization. Good job. You did it. We have a seat at the table. But a seat at the table doesn't actually mean that we're leading the product.
In terms of your experience with AIGA, because you did get into a leadership position, was that something that, again, you just fought for, or was there outreach to encourage that?
Neither. It was it was actually relatively easy to get on the board for the most part. It's kind of, there's some open roles and you can apply. Sometimes there's an interview process, sometimes there's not. When you get on the board, it's not very rigorous. And that was actually one of the other reasons why I left the organization, because there's no national oversight to how the chapters operate. And so, yeah, it really wasn't that hard. But the thing I realized was I expected AIGA to propel me in my career and to give me access to the things that I didn't normally have access to. What I didn't realize is that AIGA is very much an organization unto itself. The access is to other people, of all kinds of people around the country, but all of them really are still AIGA members. They're still kind of in their same bubble. They're doing the same thing. You know, they use the phrase drinking the Kool-Aid, and very much so they do that. And it's not to, I mean, I love many of the people who are still members, so it's not to disparage the organization, but it's the fact that it didn't diversify my experiences the way I expected it to. It gave me a great community of people to work with and to talk to. It's beautiful for the sense of community. But having it on my resume didn't increase the chances of me getting a job. Having it on my resume didn't start any interesting conversation with other people. And so that's the thing. It was a great role. It's a great way to volunteer your time and to do something within the design industry. But it almost felt as though it wasn't the design industry as a whole. It was the design industry as it relates to AIGA.
So in a situation like that, in my mind, I'm thinking, and I'm not a designer, I've never been to an AIGA meeting or anything like that, but I'm thinking that something that sounds like it has a somewhat low bar of entry to get into a position where you can hopefully develop some leadership skills. Like, it sounds like, oh, maybe that's a good thing, you know, for women, people of color to get involved and sort of cut their teeth on something like that. But at the same time, that if it's really just, well, you're getting some skills, but it's really not going to help you beyond that, then, you know, is that the kind of thing that designers, young designers who want to find themselves in leadership positions someday, is it something that they should be looking to, getting into these sort of trade associations or local community groups like that?
So I will say, and I'll definitely clarify this, is every chapter is different. Every chapter has its own level of entry, its own way of how they recruit in board members versus people who work on committees. And so I can't speak for every chapter in the United States, because there are many of them. I think the difference is how many people know about AIGA, because you have to have a chapter in your city, or you have to have attended an event, or you have to have had a chapter in your university or something along those lines. Like, there's certain ways in which you have to, that you learn about AIGA. And so to have heard about it is kind of the hard part. And so what I found is that I've had many peers who'd never heard of AIGA, and they'd been in the industry for 10 or 15 years. I've known people who are completely, like, AIGA has changed their life and has set them on a career trajectory that they'd never heard of, they never thought was possible, because just so happened they got a scholarship through AIGA to take a design course or something like that. And so, like, the experiences vary, and I can't really, I guess it would be a fallacy of generalization if I were to just say across the board, this is the organization. But I think that's kind of the hard part about this organization and many organizations like AIGA, is because there's no true consistency across every chapter, you never really know what you get until you get into it. So you may find that you join a chapter, like the DC chapter is amazing. They do great work. There's a very diverse board, and they just are great. Like, I love every person and every bit of work they do in DC. But then I've heard of other chapters, like, I'll honestly say, like in West Michigan, where I've heard of them pushing back on anything that has to do with diversity and design as a program in which they want to put forward. I've heard it's been really hard for them to even start or jumpstart any type of diversity initiative. And so because there's a mixed bag, because there are no real requirements outside of some financial and membership requirements, it's hard. And so I think, you know, you want to find an organization that's consistent, that you can constantly get the same type of experience, and that we're servicing the same, we're providing the same type of experience across the board. But it's just like joining a fraternity or sorority, right? Every place is going to be different. Their initiations may be different. And, you know, who's picked and how can be different.
Is there a path yet that a designer, a Black designer, can follow to achieve that kind of leadership? I mean, you're pursuing it. I mean, is there a path? Or are you literally carving it as you go along?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the path is to make one yourself. Is sometimes there are designers who, let's say, get lucky, or they get the right types of blessings at the right time that it pushes them forward. Other designers, they never really see that trajectory jumpstart the way they want it to. I think that also is true across the board. But again, it just depends on access. But yeah, it's just one of those things where, at least how I've seen it, or at least how I've operated in my career, is no one is opening a path or creating a path for me. So I'm making conscious decisions to create paths for myself. So, like, if you look at the fact that I've gone from South Carolina to North Carolina, North Carolina to Dallas, Dallas to or Texas, and Texas to Washington, it's because I had to chase the opportunity. No, people weren't jumping over a fence to try to get to me. I had to figure out where to go next. And I had to cast a wide net and see what was out there, find what made sense for me professionally and personally, and then just go for it.
Is that what you mean by the ugly work, or is that mostly for, or both, for other people of color or other people in leadership positions?
So the ugly work was specifically around leaders who try to tell a pretty story, and they say, hey, here's all the things we're doing, but they actually aren't doing the real work to make change in the industry. Right. That was very specific to that. But that said, I guess on some level, knowing that as a person who I have more access now, part of it I was can attribute to AIGA. Others is just based off of, you know, what I've tried to do. I've actually probably gotten more access since I've left AIGA because of the response from it than while I was in it. But yeah, like, some of the access I have now, you know, I've kind of had to develop on my own. I've had to figure out pathways to get to it. And the thing is, for me, is like, I know there's someone who can be way more successful than me, because honestly, I'm a very introverted person. I'm not really great with humans. I'm horrible with small talk. So,
so you're doing pretty good right now.
Right. Well, that, I mean, you know, it's because I don't see anyone around.
I'm the same way.
But yeah, so like, if someone who is more charismatic, more extroverted than me, who can tell even better stories than I can, there are people out there who are doing really great work and who are pushing forward, who may not be in the limelight, but they're setting a path to a place where they can eventually be in that light and be a guide for someone else. I think they definitely have an opportunity to do it. I'm going to try my best, but I feel like I'm a bit of a radical person, so I'm always going to rock the boat a little bit. And some people will love and some people will hate that. And that's completely fine. I'm comfortable with being that person.
So as we wrap up, are there any resources that you've come across throughout your career that you feel helped you, especially as it pertains to, you know, you pursuing opportunities to lead teams or to lead community or to create leadership opportunities for yourself or other people of color?
Oh, resources. I will say that I'm working with some folks who are doing the Design Plus Diversity Conference. And so one of the things I'm doing with, or I'm helping them on, is we're creating a fellowship. And so that fellowship is for emerging designers who are juniors and seniors in college, or at least 3 years out of, or no more than 3 years out of college, to apply for a fellowship to basically come to the conference for free. And then we'll also give them, you know, some free resources to help them out, whether it's a year's subscription to Adobe. Adobe is the premier sponsor, or other resources to be able to start their career or jumpstart their career. So that's designplusdiversity.com. And then outside of that, honestly, most of the things that I do and the way that I operate, I've Googled the heck out of everything. Like, I should say Bing technically, but I searched every time I have a question, every time I'm curious about something, I just look for things. I've leveraged LinkedIn a good bit, and like, I'll just reach out to leaders who are in positions who are above me, and I'll say, hey, I'm not looking for a job or anything. I just would love to have coffee with you just to like learn about your journey. Like, I just want to, I want to hear about your journey, where you are today. And that's agnostic of race. I've done that for males, females, black, white, and everything in between. And again, I really am not great with people, but I at least try to do that here and there. And then every now and then I try to reach back whenever I can. If someone says, hey, I know someone who's looking for something or they need some help with some things, I'll always try to reach back if I can. There was this wonderful young lady who actually went to RISD. She was a woman of color. And she was so lost. She was like, I don't know what to do. I graduate from this school. It's technically the best design school in the world. And I don't know if my work is good enough. And I don't know what's the next step for me. And I just kind of gave her some advice based off of my own personal experience. And I mean, I do that really with anyone, black, white, male, female, it doesn't matter. So that's kind of my thing. I'm not sure if that's helpful for anyone else, but at least it's a good start. Like, just start Googling the heck out of it and look for patterns. One of the things about being a designer, especially empathy in design, is you look for patterns and you build hypothesis based off of that. So if you have a question, look for patterns and see if you can find, if usually that's the right answer, if you see the same answer coming up multiple times from multiple sources.
Very cool. I mean, this was such an important discussion, but that's all the time we have for today. But before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready?
I'll try.
Okay. First question. What's your go-to karaoke song?
I don't do karaoke. I've never done karaoke in my life. True story. Oh, no, wait. That's not true. I just did it last week. Oh.
It made an impression.
But I don't recall. I mean, I'll do anything that's like old school because, you know, like in my mind, I'm old head. So, you know, bring me some old school R&B anytime.
All right. What advice would you give your younger self?
Keep going, have patience, have more fun, travel more. I didn't travel enough when I was in college and younger. Like, just go places and experience the world more. Don't wait.
What's your favorite PG-rated curse word?
I always say, oh, sugar. Like, sugar.
Who is your favorite superhero?
Black Panther, duh.
Oh, you and Leia got to see that together,
yes,
right?
Yes, it was great.
Yes, it was the best.
It was the best. I made her husband have an asthma attack.
Yeah, he was laughing so hard, yeah. What is your favorite time of the year?
I love equinoxes, but I also, I love equinoxes because I can wear my sweatshirts and stuff. So it's like just cool enough to look sexy because I love winter fashion. But still warm enough that I don't like die of cold.
Yeah, I call that hoodie weather.
Yes.
If you can change one thing about the web, what would it be?
How confusing it can be for people. Like, when it comes to like trusting the web.
What are three words that describe you?
The black guy.
What are three words that describe your work?
Rational, empathetic, and straightforward. That's a hyphenated word, so it counts.
What's your favorite meal of the day?
Yes.
No wonder you and Leia are friends.
Exactly.
All right, last question, Tim. Coffee or tea?
Neither technically, but I'll do a green tea. I'm not a coffee drinker at all. I'll probably drink green tea before I do a coffee.
Mm. All right. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show, Tim.
Thank you.
In case our listeners wanted to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Super simple. Honestly, I'll just tell you just Google my name, Timothy Bardlevens, B as in boy, A-R-D as in dog, L-A-V as in Victor, E-N-S. All my everything will show up from there just because I am one of two Timothy Bartlevenses in the world, as far as I know, and the other is my father, and I don't think he has any kind of digital footprint, so you should be fine.
All right, this was awesome. Thanks again for joining us, Tim.
Thank you.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency invested in education and social good. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsors. Many thanks to FosterMaid and Statamic.
We'd also like to thank our hosting partner, Archistech.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, consider donating to the show. Then give us a review on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts. Or both. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune into our next episode when Alex Mejias joins us to talk about business development for digital agencies. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.